From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Christiane Amanpour has been with CNN almost as long as the network has existed. She covered the first Gulf War, the Bosnian War, and the Arab Spring. She's host of CNN International's flagship news show, Amanpour. It airs weeknights on GPB and other PBS stations as Amanpour and Company. Christiane Amanpour was in Atlanta this month to accept her place in the Atlanta Press Club Hall of Fame. I met up with her before the ceremony.
Well, congratulations, first of all, for your Hall of Fame award, among many awards.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back in Atlanta.
Well, this is a town that loves you well. You're a face that people know all over the world, but you got your start in Atlanta, right? Just after J school?
I did. I didn't even go to J school. I was at the University of Rhode Island, where I got my bachelor's degree in journalism and communications. And I had worked as an intern, and then I got a job at the local
NBC.
Yes, the local NBC affiliate there. And it was wonderful, although it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do with my life, because I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. And the job that I got there was electronic graphics, what we call fonts. You know, I had to put the temperatures for the weatherman and then the names under whoever was being profiled on the news. And sometimes I would get it wrong, and sometimes they would call me out live on air. But hey, you know, I called it baptism by fire. But in the end, and luckily, there were a bunch of people there who actually knew about CNN, which was in its infancy. Mm-hmm. We're talking 1983 now. And I called up CNN, the human resources, such that it was. And I got accepted as a very, very, very bottom of the rung entry level. So it was great.
I was told that you arrived with a bicycle and very few dollars.
Yeah, I had, I want to say $115, something like that, a bicycle, a suitcase, and that was it. And at the time, and this is 1983, young girls did not bike around Atlanta. I was an object of some fascination, scorn, and a little bit of abuse as well.
Well, that may have been good training for things that you were going to do in the future, doing a lot of courageous things. On the war front, there was a headline in the New York Times, "Where there's war, there's Amanpour." And you were in Rwanda.
Efugenia Mukantabana lived in a rural hilltop village when the genocide erupted. As Efugenia hid in the forest, her neighbors, Hutus she had lived with all of her life, killed her husband and five of her children.
You were at the Gulf War.
We go now to what may be the center of the storm, Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, of course, and CNN's Christiane Amanpour, who's standing by live. Christiane?
Good morning, Jonathan. In Baghdad, you would hardly know, you would not know at all that a ground offensive has started. It's been an extremely quiet night. There have been no air raid sirens, an extremely quiet morning.
You reported the Bosnian conflict.
This was a daily occurrence, dodging bullets as we covered the unfolding tragedy. For the Bosnian Muslims, the villain was clear.
This is one of the ways that people came to know you all over the world. What was the draw for you to conflict zones?
Well, I really wanted to go and be a foreign correspondent, and a foreign correspondent essentially is a war correspondent. And I suppose it was born of my having lived through my own turmoil as an Iranian, a British Iranian, growing up at the time of the Iranian Revolution in Tehran. And I was able to see it all unfolding in real time before my eyes. And I was not political. I was not at all into current affairs, current events. I didn't really know anything about that. So I got a very fast lesson on the, wasn't even a job, but, you know, in real life, watching total turbulence. And because it affected my whole country and because it affected my family, my community, I realized that it was a very big deal. And I hadn't quite clocked how it would affect the rest of the world and the relations it would mean with America, the influence of the Iranian Revolution around the Middle East and elsewhere. But I knew it was something big enough and serious enough. And I suddenly realized that's actually what I would like to do with my life, explain these big events to people around the world and to tell these stories. And that's what led me to want to be a journalist and a foreign correspondent, which is what led me to Rhode Island and to university and then to my first internship and then to CNN as my entry-level job. But and I'm still there, yes. 35 years later.
But as a correspondent, I read these stories of you camping out with your crew in tents next to airfield, you know, parachuting into Tbilisi. a really gritty, intense job. And we often think of people who are war correspondents as, you know, kind of adrenaline junkies on some level. Do you think that's you?
Look, I always reject that term because I think it's just too easy. I mean, you know, I don't think I'm an adrenaline junkie, nor am I a war crazy, nor am I, you know, all those terms that get flung around, because I think by people who don't understand what it takes to actually do this job, and people ask themselves, well, who would get up from their fairly comfortable life and leave their family, leave their daily comforts, and go and put themselves in the line of fire and in very, very difficult situations. It really, as you can imagine, started as a hardship post, and now it's got even worse. In the many years since I've been doing it, it's much, much worse. So I do reject the way people describe us. But I will say that you obviously couldn't get through this job if you didn't have adrenaline to save you. What is adrenaline? It's the fight or flight motivator. And if you don't have that, you're just going to fall apart or be killed or wounded if you can't cope with the danger that comes at you. So we do need that, and that gets us through the immediate task at hand. However, the real motivation is to tell the stories and to be the eyes and ears of those who obviously, for obvious reasons, can't everybody, millions of people can't suddenly get up and go to Iraq or Afghanistan or Bosnia or Rwanda or wherever to find out what's going on. But millions of people are interested and millions of people need to know, and it's important.
To comprehend the magnitude of what faces Rwanda's justice system, you have to come here to a prison where those accused of genocide are locked up. Almost no one here has seen a lawyer, nor do they know the specific charge lodged against them.
All of the people in here have been charged or are on suspicion of having committed genocide.
Yes, yes, yes.
Why should we feel sorry for you?
Some of us are innocent.
So that's where we come in. That's where foreign correspondents and journalists come in, to go out and get the facts and to report the news and get the evidence, which inevitably shapes policy, shapes the world, and shapes our modern-day history.
So what was the transition like for you to go from that to Amanpour in 2009, where you get to have longer conversations in a much more settled place? How can you speak to those events that people care about differently?
Well, I always said when I first started doing a studio show, which was actually in 2009, and it was really, again, born of necessity. My family, we came from London, where I was based for CNN as a foreign correspondent, the chief correspondent, came to New York and got my son in school, and then I had to figure out what to do and how to reshape my career, because it was bound to be less easy to be a foreign correspondent going everywhere all the time from New York. It's just further away from the world, both physically and emotionally, intellectually. It's just further away. And so I was very fortunate that CNN agreed that I would do a foreign affairs program based in New York for a certain period of time. I still did travel, but not on a, you know, daily and constant basis. And that was actually really interesting for me, because I was still a reporter, and I felt that my value added as a studio journalist was to do these interviews, to bring people's reports in from the field, just like I had done before, but to kind of bring the field into the studio. And all my interviews, obviously, are informed and framed by all the experience I've had in the field. So I think when people sit with me, they know that I come at it from an authentic place and from a place of experience, and there's very little that they can get past me, because I've been there and I've done it and I know it, and I'm always learning. And I think that's, if I have a value added in as a studio presenter now with my program in the United States, Amanpour and Company, which is on PBS, it's that. It's that I bring my experience from the field to the table.
Well, and I went back and watched, I've watched the recent shows, but just going back and looking at some of the conversations, you know, telling Nicolas Maduro, why were 70 journalists arrested?
There have been dozens, maybe 70 members of the press who have been arrested, been targeted during these demonstrations. Would you say now that the press is welcome to do their work here?
Siempre ha sido así,
always,
y siempre
and
será.
It's been always la única the case, agresión and it will be the case.
Gaddafi telling you, well, my people love me, that's why I won't leave the country.
Talking to Western journalists for the first time since the unrest began, he gave this response to the question, will he leave Libya?
They love me, all my people with me, they love me all.
Medvedev, you know, about children in Syria who are starving.
100,000 plus people have been killed in the last 3 years in Syria. There is starvation in the land, haunting many people. Do you think that there's really going to be some kind of solution?
I am optimistic.
Really holding people's feet to the fire. And I wonder in your career, now that we have, if people are dissatisfied with the news or the interview that they give, they say, oh, well, that was fake news. That was just somebody making this kind of thing up. So if viewers can't discern truth from fiction, where is journalism now?
Well, look, I think that is the biggest threat to our civilization, to be frank, and to our democracies and to our civil society, to our community. Obviously, propaganda is as old as time immemorial. It's as old as politics, it's as old as history, it really is. People, politicians, leaders, generals, media, if it's in, you know, if it's in hock to the state, have used propaganda forever to get their side and across and to color, whether it's by lies or sleight of hand or whatever, to color their reality and to be able to put their, to win the argument or the war or the election or whatever it might be. The difference is that when democratic leaders start questioning their own free press and, you know, sowing doubts, that's when it becomes very, very dangerous. So if you have the President of the United States starting a war with his own media in his own country, then that certainly is a problem for those of us who have to work in this field, but it's even more than that. It shakes the very foundation of democracy. It shakes the very foundations of fact and evidence and a truth-based society. And I genuinely strongly believe, based on obviously my reading of history, my experience and my news coverage and my reporting over these last several decades around the world, and having been to democracies, emerging democracies, autocracies, dictatorships, monarchies, the whole gamut of governance and government, that the difference between freedom and slavery, freedom and captivity, politically, is truth and lies. The difference between a democracy and a dictatorship is truth and lies. Dictatorships survive on lies, survive on manipulating the truth. Democracies thrive on the truth and on evidence.
We're going to continue our conversation with Christiane Amanpour and ask her about defying predictions as a woman in the news business in the 1980s. It's after a short break when On Second Thought continues. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a war correspondent and host on CNN International, Christiane Amanpour is one of the best-known journalists in the world. She now hosts the flagship news show Amanpour, which airs weeknights on GPB and other PBS stations as Amanpour and Company. She's had a long and varied career, and at one point was accused of taking sides in her reporting, especially during the Bosnian War, which critics said violated the standards of objectivity. Amanpour famously responded that she is not just a stenographer, and in the face of unspeakable horror, when you're neutral, you're an accessory. Well, that is a well-covered part of her career, so we spoke of other things when we caught up with her before she accepted the Atlanta Press Club Hall of Fame Award.
You just recently interviewed Jon Stewart along with Dave Chappelle for your show, I'm in Porn Company. And he said, the press has taken the bait. We're playing in this fight. We are, over and over again, we are taking it personally, the way that we are attacked by the president.
We, I think, believe that our job is to navigate the truth and to do the fact-checking and all the rest of it. So I think that's what motivates a lot of people.
But I think the journalists have taken it personally.
Okay,
they're personally wounded and offended by this man. He baits them, and they dive in. And what he's done well, I thought, is appeal to their own narcissism, to their own ego.
So what role is the press playing in this?
Well, look, I think we're in a very emotional and difficult area right now. The president decided shortly after his election, before his inauguration, to use that word fake news and to direct it first at CNN, and then it became used by leaders all over the place. It became used by leaders in the rest of the world. When they didn't like something or when they were just joking, they would say, oh, you're fake news. Well, it's not a big laugh, and it's not funny, and it's not a joke, and it's getting everybody into a lot of trouble, and it's overheating the atmosphere. So it's a very emotional relationship right now. I would say from our perspective as journalists, we have a duty to hold the line. We have a duty to resist our own democratically elected leaders in free democracies where, especially in the United States, there is a First Amendment that protects the freedom of expression, obviously, but the safety and the freedom of journalists and the right to, you know, broadcast and
be at a press conference at the White House, for example.
Our job is to hold that line and to stand up for the truth, and we have to keep doing that. But I do think we, at the same time, have to watch out that we're not dragged down somebody else's rabbit hole, that we're not sort of pulled in every which way and every direction by people who are very good at manipulating the media. The president is very, very good at this, and we need to recognize that. He has a particular style, born of his reality television experience, The Apprentice, the way he's had the media work for him and for his business for decades and decades. And now he occupies the highest office in the land, and some would say the highest office in the world. And this is the way he knows how to communicate, by shaping the story to his liking and by, you know, trying to silence those he dislikes and information that he dislikes. Okay, so we know that's the game, but now we have to hold our own, and we mustn't get pulled into somebody else's game. We need to step back a little bit, just keep doing our job, and not get whipped into a frenzy. That's what I genuinely believe. But that does not mean to say we should surrender or bend over.
In journalism circles, there's a question of should we report the president's tweets? There's very rarely any real policy content in them. Is it just a way of kind of misdirection? And I wondered if you had
thoughts. Look, the president's tweets are his way of communicating with the country and with the world. What he says in his tweets are what he believes and what he enacts and what he does. That's his policy making. That's what he does. Everybody around the world is reading his tweets. It's not just us journalists. It's foreign leaders. It's anywhere in the world, they're reading it to understand what's happening at the center of power, at the top of power in the world. So in the White House, in the Oval Office, you know, what's coming from the president of the United States. So we can't ignore that. The question is, how do you do it? Do you treat it like a press release or a statement? Or do you go endlessly on for days and hours and 24/7 just constantly repeating these tweets? I think you can use the tweets as material fact from the White House and then examine the policy around it. That's journalism. There's nothing wrong with that. I think what's wrong is when one gets, again, caught up in just talking about these tweets 24/7. Mm. Because then you're playing on somebody else's playing field. You are complicit in their agenda, and we are meant to be independent press people, and neither supporting nor deriding their agenda, but just reporting it. And I think that's what we have to concentrate on right now. And I would say one more thing. You know, I'm very upset that the president of the United States is so angry all the time with the press in this country of all countries. But I'm very, very upset because it has a snowball and a knock-on effect around the world. And I will say that the death and the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi happens in a permissive environment, when the constant denigration of the press, not just from the White House, but from all over the world, from Venezuela, from Turkey, from Mexico, from
Philippines,
from Saudi, everywhere. Now they can say, well, President of the United States does it. He says it.
You yourself, I don't believe, thinks that we, the press, are the enemy of the people. Do you believe that?
I've said that, no.
You don't believe that? At what point is there a red line for you personally in the rhetoric causing potential danger and having consequences?
Yeah, well, there's a lot in your extended statement, so let me just say this. I don't think the press writ large is the enemy of the people. I do find the press often in their coverage of this White House and this administration and this president to be the enemy of the relevant.
When you first came to CNN, you told Ed Turner, no relation
no
to
relation.
Ted Turner. That you were going to be a foreign correspondent.
Yes.
And how did he treat it? He sort
well,
of
look,
laughed
I think
about-
a lot of people laughed at me. Certainly, Ed Turner was the vice president, and he was, you know, he had a job to do, and he had to get this show on the road every single day. And but CNN at the time was, it was 1983, and it was at a time when CNN actually had much more opportunity for people to come in at the ground level and work their way up. So I did not ever take no for an answer. And, you know, I look back, particularly in this post-Me Too environment right now, and I consider myself very fortunate that I never had to go through that kind of horrendous harassment, assault, abuse. But there's no doubt that sexism and misogyny play a huge role in our business and in every single walk of life, every single walk of life. And I was not exempt from that. However, I was never, you know, never abused, never harassed, and I made it to where I wanted to get to, which is at the top of the pile, and I'm really, really proud of it, and I'm proud that I've stayed there for all these years, despite my advancing age, that I'm still up there, I'm still competitive, I'm still doing my own thing, and I'm really proud of that as a woman. I really am proud of it, and I hope that many, many more women keep coming up the ranks, which they are, of course, but I want to see more women in the executive suite. I want to see women presidents of news organizations. I want to see that because it will change, and I want to see them in, you know, running all sorts of corporations, and I want to see equality, not one gender dominating another. Either way, I want to see equality because that will change. That will change our world. There's no doubt about it.
I've worked in the Balkans after, long after you were there, actually, in the, when it was a post-conflict zone in West Africa, South Africa, and all over CNN International is there. And I can't tell you how many people I met who've named their daughters Christiane.
Oh, nice thing to say.
What does that mean to you?
It means a lot. You know, in Australia, they even named a horse Amanpour. So horses, dogs, kids, it's great. I love it. Because I tell you what, I hope that people look at me as somebody who will always tell them the truth, that I have their back when it comes to telling them what's what around the world. But I hope that I can continue to measure up to people's expectations.
Thank you for continuing to do the work you do.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
That's CNN and PBS anchor Christiane Amanpour. She hosts Amanpour & Company weeknights at 11 on PBS stations in the U.S., including on GPB-TV. Amanpour was in Atlanta to be inducted into the Atlanta Press Club Hall of Fame. Well, it was the lawsuit heard round Washington after a contentious interaction between CNN's Jim Acosta and President Donald Trump in the White House briefing room. Acosta's press pass was revoked. Here's the interaction that set it all off. Acosta asked Trump about the migrant caravan traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border.
They're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question. Mr. President, if I may.
CNN sued the White House to restore Acosta's credentials after 20 days. They were restored when the White House conceded, but only after instituting some new rules for journalists to follow. CNN dropped the lawsuit. But the brouhaha opened up a conversation about the role of the press at a transformative time for media. Are they instigators, upholders of the Constitution, or, as the president often says, enemies of the people? Jonathan Peters is assistant journalism professor at UGA and press freedom correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you, Virginia.
Well, I'm glad to have you with us. So maybe as journalists, we get more clued into events like this. But why should people who aren't in the media be paying attention to this altercation and its outcomes?
The retaliation against CNN and Jim Acosta for engaging in protected news gathering and reporting, for basically putting hard questions to the president, that has the effect of chilling the work of other journalists who cover the administration, harming both them and the public that relies on the press to hold our leaders accountable for both their words and deeds. And so another way of putting this is that journalists act as public representatives when gathering news. Most of us, most citizens who have busy lives, they can't get for themselves all of the information that they need to be informed and to participate in the political process. So they rely on the press for some help. And in that sense, journalists aim to uncover truths, sometimes uncomfortable truths, about public affairs and to ensure that the free and fair exchange of accurate information. Journalists want to safeguard for the public's benefit. They want to make sure that the public's business is conducted in the open and that government decisions and positions are interrogated. All of this is baked into our constitutional system, too. The First Amendment protects the uninhibited, robust, and wide-open debate of public issues, as the U.S. Supreme Court once put it. And the court has also said that speech concerning public affairs is more than self-expression. It is the essence of self-government. The First Amendment recognizes the critical role played by the press in that system, which guarantees the right of journalists not only to speak, to broadcast, and to publish, but also to gather news. And that includes a right of access to places closed to the public, but open generally to the press, such as news conferences at the White House.
Right, and the press, the White House briefing room. But let me just cut in here for a second and mm-hmm. say, you know, we just heard Christiane Amanpour talking about the danger of Democratic leaders questioning the press. And then her interview with a Trump official saying, well, this press is especially hard on this president. Now, Acosta challenged the president's Trump characterization of the migrant caravan as an invasion. Do you see? I mean, has this been a more frequent role of journalists? You said holding feet to the fire, acting on behalf of the American people to figure out what is really going on and to create transparency. Is this challenging of politicians different now than it has been in the past?
I'm not sure about comparative frequency, but that has long been part of journalism's mission, holding public officials accountable and, where merited, challenging them on facts. In 2006, for example, reporters at the New York Times published stories exposing a secret domestic eavesdropping program authorized by President Bush that journalists had previously been told did not exist. In 1987, Miami Herald reporters helped to blow open the U.S.-Iran-Contra connection through both persistent and incredulous reporting. So I think that all responsible and diligent news organizations, whether it's one of those newspapers or it's CNN, it's NPR, it's ProPublica, they all share the mission of investigating claims made by public officials. And a press that does that through accurate and informative reporting is a press that improves the civic health of a democracy. And yes, there can be an adversarial tone at the heart of investigative and public affairs journalism. Reporters are sometimes cast as challengers to the concentrated power of government and sometimes of the corporate state. And that's as it should be. It's as the First Amendment intended. And that applies as much to coverage of President Bill Clinton during his administration as it does to coverage of President Donald Trump during his.
Well, let's share just as we head into the break, one example of those kind of exchanges with Acosta, Jim Acosta again from CNN, tense relationship with the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Here's one of their exchanges in October about Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony.
I don't have any problem stating facts, no, John.
Thank you, Sarah. Just five
I know that's
ago.
Something you probably do have a problem with, but I don't.
Actually, Sarah, we do state the facts, and I think there have been many occasions when you don't state the facts, if I may respond.
John, go ahead.
All right, so pretty testy relationship there, and we're going to be continuing to talk about that with Jonathan Peters. He is a professor, assistant professor of journalism at University of Georgia. He's with us in Athens. We're talking today about media. We had such a great conversation with Christiane Amanpour, but so many things left on the table that we're picking up, and we'll continue those after the break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're talking with UGA's Jonathan Peters about the changing role of journalism under President Trump, who frequently vilifies the press as the enemy of the people. Jonathan, I want to pick up just the idea of this, or the event of the White House revoking Jim Acosta's press pass. There was a tussle in which a White House intern tried to take away his microphone, and the White House released a video of the incident and characterized it as aggressive. Can you just give us the facts on that incident in the video?
Yes. The White House intern approached Jim Acosta in the middle of the press briefing as Jim Acosta was trying to ask a follow-up question, attempted to take a microphone from him. He said, he essentially said, you know, please don't, ma'am, or something to that effect. And a little bit later that evening, Jim Acosta found through Twitter, not through direct communication to him, that his hard pass credential, which gives him access privileges on the White House grounds and throughout parts of the West Wing and in the press facilities at the White House, that hard pass had been revoked. And that, of course, prompted litigation by CNN against various White House officials, including the president himself.
Now, the White House's video that they released was actually found to have been speeded up so that it appeared that Acosta was actually sort of, you know, karate chopping, I guess, for lack of a better word. And Kellyanne Conway, after being pressed, told Chris Wallace of Fox News, no, it wasn't altered. It was just speeded up. CNN filed a lawsuit to reinstate Acosta's access. Is there precedent for a news organization suing the White House for access?
There's not much of it. This is an exceedingly rare occasion. CNN actually sued the White House and major broadcast networks back in the 1980s, and that was when the kind of CNN in its infancy was trying to get access to the pool that covered the White House. They had been denied that access, and so they sued. That is the closest analog and precedent for what we've seen here. And the latest iteration is the dropping of the lawsuit by CNN and Acosta in light of a White House letter sent to both of them informing them that they were restoring Acosta's hard pass, but at the same time setting out new rules that would govern journalistic conduct at press briefings.
And there were several news organizations, including NPR, our mother network, and Fox News, widely thought to be a kind of mouthpiece for the Trump administration, that supported Jim Acosta's getting his press pass back. But this new rules that they defined as decorum, quote unquote, how is decorum defined here?
So here what the White House did initially was refer generically to decorum and the need to respect it at the White House, including in press briefings. After that, though, the White House set out specific content-neutral rules that would apply not just to Jim Acosta or to CNN, but to all journalists and all news organizations that participate at press briefings. And so one of them says, for example, that a journalist is entitled to one question if called upon, and it is at the discretion of the person running the press conference, whether that would be Sarah Sanders or President Trump or some other White House official. It is entirely at that person's discretion whether a follow-up question will be permitted, And violation of that rule. So, for example, if Sarah Sanders would not allow for a follow-up question and the journalist would persist, that would allow for punishment to be meted out through the credentialing system. And that could include the suspension of a journalist's credentials.
Well, as you've noted, as we've all seen in the past, there is an inherent tension to that briefing room, the politician or the spokesperson says something, and then the journalists follow up, holding them to it. But the press seems to be increasingly under fire, especially since the 2016 campaign and election of President Donald Trump. Here's an example of some audio from a rally.
She's back there, little Katie. She's back there. What a lie it was. No, what a lie. Katie Turr. What a lie it was from NBC to have written that was a total lie.
I actually interviewed Katie Turr from MSNBC, and she was singled out by the president, and she said she was actually terrified. The press was in the middle of these rallies, surrounded sometimes by thousands of people and, you know, cordoned off by basically bike racks. In some cases, the Secret Service had to usher them out. So what is the message here for journalists? Should they just get thicker skin? Or does this kind of behavior harm democracy?
Mm-hmm. I think that more broadly, our current moment is critical for press freedom. The president denounces the press nearly every day. Other elected officials are parroting his rhetoric. Reporters are being assaulted while covering protests. They're being arrested, too, and they're being sued by the wealthy, increasingly in lawsuits that are meritless. And meanwhile, public opinion of the press is low. And recent surveys have shown that a majority of daily newspaper editors feel that news organizations are no longer prepared financially to go to court to preserve First Amendment freedoms. Another recent survey showed that it was 84% of Americans say that the press is critical to democracy, but only 28% feel that the press is actually performing its role well. Individual journalists can't do their jobs if the institution of the press is delegitimized or if the legal protections for that institution are not understood. A kind of a more cosmic way of thinking about this is that a free press, however imperfect it is the lifeblood of a healthy democracy in which, you know, journalists are both benefactors and beneficiaries of the First Amendment in the sense that they protect and rely on its freedoms to inform their communities and to enable democratic participation. You know, that is how high the stakes are.
I want to pick up on that because you talked about both Pew and Gallup have shown trust of media at an all-time low. And this is at the same time that news outlets are proliferating. Do you think the deterioration of that trust has anything to do with the fact that so many new sources of news have emerged in the past 10, 20, especially, I think, 5 years?
There probably is a relationship there because some Gallup polling also shows that even though the public is grateful for having a variety of news and information sources available to them, the vast majority of American news-consuming adults say that the variety has made it difficult for them to navigate the media environment. And so they are having difficulty sussing out what is a credible source of information, what is not, particularly in the in the two-year period that we are in now, in which there has been so much public discussion of, you know, so-called fake news. And the majority of American adults believe that fake news is a problem. It is a problem that merits a solution, but they can't agree on two critical issues. Number one is, what exactly is fake news? How do we conceptualize it? And then two, how exactly do we address it? Do we do it through governmental regulation? Do we do it through media literacy education? Or by, for example, asking our social media platforms that increasingly host our public discussions to be better citizens in the public discourse?
We're talking with Jonathan Peters. He's assistant professor of journalism at UGA about the state of the news ecosystem, I think, for lack of a better word, trying to get a read on that. And while you're talking about fake news, Jonathan, news has become increasingly tribal, I could say, just like the rest of society may be reflecting that. Or let's say that there are a number of news outlets that represent a particular point of view. Is this is obviously there's a profit motive behind that. On social media, fake news sells, or the more outrageous the story, the more it gets retweeted, the more it gets passed around on social media. There is a question in journalism circles about whether or not social media has been good for reporting. What would you say?
It's a legitimate question to ask, and it's one that doesn't lend itself to an easy answer because social media, on the one hand, have enabled news organizations and journalists, particularly independent journalists, those who are not full-time employees of institutionalized media organizations, to have their voices heard. And it's important to recognize that full-time employed journalists are not the only people who are capable of performing journalistic acts, of holding government officials to account for words and deeds. We see this, and this was evident in Christian Amanpour's comments in the segment before mine, at protest, where we see ordinary protesters, ordinary citizens showing up to be heard and at the same time document assembly activities. And so social media, I think, not to be cliche, but they have been to some degree democratizing by giving a megaphone to people who, as the old saying goes, wouldn't be able to afford to buy a printing press for themselves. But at the same time, we are navigating now propaganda that I am sure Mark Zuckerberg and others could not have anticipated at the time that they founded their platforms.
So people can exist inside of a media universe that is completely divorced from any alternative points of view. We've seen that over and over again, or heard evidence of it. How about for reporters? There are a lot of accusations that Twitter is too inside, or that reporters are inside of their own media bubble. I saw it myself looking at, during the Kavanaugh hearings, for example, looking at what was going on Twitter and what was being reported, and then what happened in the real world of public opinion. Do you think the media is inside of its own bubble and playing its own role in this tribalism?
It certainly can be. Twitter is the favored medium of journalists. It's used much more, for example, than as compared to Facebook. The marketplace of ideas is one of the philosophical organizing principles of the First Amendment. And one of its assumptions is that all manner of ideas will compete with one another in the marketplace openly for acceptance, and that good ideas in the long run will win out over so-called bad ideas. And there are weaknesses in the marketplace theory. One of them is that not everybody has equal access to the marketplace. One thing, though, that the marketplace never could have anticipated is the way that social media can pervert the prominence of certain ideas in that marketplace. And what I mean by that is the marketplace and its theorists, so going back to the 15 and 1600s, they never could have anticipated artificial intelligence. They could not have anticipated Russian bots that would be able to pollute a marketplace of ideas and make certain ideas, positions, philosophical ideologies appear to be more popular or prominent or accepted than they are.
Right.
And so that is a danger more broadly, not just within the news media, but for the public discourse.
Right. So things get amplified in a way. We got a note from someone on Twitter. Michaela said, "It is not just a journalism problem. It is real in so many spheres. We want our truth out front. We want to paint only certain narratives for our sake, our agenda." Of course, on the 2016 trail again, and since, we've seen, Trump supporters wearing T-shirts that say "Rope, Tree, Journalist, Some Assembly Required," a pretty heavy and violent and threatening baiting of American journalism. But what do you think, Jonathan? What are some of the healthy questions we should be asking of our media, holding their feet to the fire?
Sure. I think that we need to demand more of the media in terms of attribution. And this is not a new problem. I tell all of my students that you should make promises of anonymity and confidentiality only in the rarest and most extraordinary circumstances, because readers, listeners, viewers like to know as much as possible about your sources so that they can make independent judgments about their credibility, their biases, their motives for sharing information. So I think that we need to be as open with our audiences as possible. I think our obligations also demand of us that when and where we make mistakes, we correct them prominently, we do it promptly, and we give the corrections the same degree of prominence that we gave the initial claims. And you know, we are not an error-free press. In our history as an American press is one that has been political. It's one that has been scurrilous at times, and you know, that will never not be the case. And so I think what that demands of us is that we bring a neutrality of method to the work that we do. We can't expect journalists as human beings, as individuals, to be objective, to be able to foreclose themselves from their life experiences. But what we can expect of them is that when they investigate a story, they use neutral methods. They don't come to the story with a presupposed notion of what the outcome is going to be. That is fair and reasonable, and I think we should expect that of all news organizations and all journalists.
Here is Krista Tippett. She's host now of On Being, about her identity as a journalist. That speaks to what you were just talking about.
You know, when I was working for Nightline and I went to Turkey after there was a terrible earthquake there and, like, you know, thousands of people were killed, and I was feeling really useless, thinking, boy, I wish I were a doctor. I wish I were a structural engineer. I wish I could do something more useful. But then people would come up to me and say, thank you for being here. And I would feel like, wow, why are they thanking me?
I'm sorry, that's Michelle Martin. That is not Krista Tippett. Misidentified that. But let's get to that. We've got just half a minute left, Jonathan. We were talking earlier, Christiane Amanpour asked Jon Stewart about one's own defense system, one's own narcissism, taking the bait. Do you think journalists are taking the bait in this contentious relationship with President Trump?
I think some journalists probably are. I think a lot of them are not. I think I've seen far more journalists who have continued to do their jobs without attitude, without ego, with the right mission in mind, which is to get at the best obtainable version of the truth, to tell accurate and informed stories. I think for the most part, journalists have, you know, brushed off the anti-press rhetoric that has come their way, a lot of it unfair and unfounded. But yes, you wouldn't have to look hard to find some who have, indulged themselves or flattered themselves through their responses to that criticism either. But
Jonathan,
I don't think that that's the majority.
I have to stop you, and I'm so sorry for that. And thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Jonathan Peters, assistant journalism professor at UGA and press freedom correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more on Second Thoughts.